You're listening to Delve Talks, a podcast that digs into the challenges around design, product development, leadership, and innovation. Your host, Dave Franchino, is the president of Delve, a design and innovation consultancy.
Hello, everybody. Dave Franchino here once again. And as usual, I'm joined by our Vice President of Strategy, Steph Nervisis. And today's guest, Julia Nervisis. You'll probably recognize the similarity in the last names. Julie and Steph are sisters, and we were fortunate enough to work with Julie, who worked with Steph to start our strategy and research offering here at Delve. But since then, she's gone on to an amazing career and is currently the Senior Director of User Research at LinkedIn. And I know all of our listeners are familiar with LinkedIn. Obviously founded in 2003, LinkedIn is the world's largest professional social network for 675 million members worldwide, and obviously a vital part of many, many businesses today, including our own. So thank you very much for joining us, Julie. Really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, I'm thrilled to be here. It's always nice to spend time with you, Dave, and of course, my beloved sister, Steph. So I'm really excited for an exciting conversation.
And once again, our objective with these conversations is just to talk with individuals about a culture of innovation. We've been facilitating conversations with a wide range of people, different backgrounds, different experiences, and using them to share some of the insights and wisdom that they've applied that our listeners might be able to apply within their field. So thank you very much, Julie, for joining us. Maybe to start us off, if you could walk us through your background, it might be good context for our listeners to understand the perspective you're bringing to the topic of innovation.
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying I'll go way back in the way back machine. My background academically is in art history, which seems a little bit far afield maybe, but I was always obsessed with this idea of choices. There is a work of art. The artist was influenced by their own psychology, by culture, history, kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and communities of artists to create individual works of art that are representations of a collection of choices. I always found this really fascinating, in particular with Mondrian paintings. I would just stare at them and think, like, why is this black line here and this one here? And why is this cube red and this one yellow and this one blue? I just was fascinated by the logic there. And this kind of, I was fortunate enough, Steph started working at a strategic innovation firm, which was at the intersection of design and social science and business called Doblin. And so she started to expose me to the ideas of design. And then I became really fascinated with the idea of choice in the built world. So what are the choices? You know, frankly, when I was very young, I was like, why is everything weird, ugly, and broken? Like, who's making all these choices to put things in the world? And how can I help make it better? It becomes an interchange, just like art between the consumer and the creator, any kind of product design or service design or experience design, in any level is also that interplay between what are the choices that individuals and teams and companies are making to put things out into the world, and then how are consumers and people, humans, making choices about what to bring into their lives and what to use and how to use them. So I've always just been like really fascinated by that. And fortunate enough to get exposed to the world of design and then research to help fuel those choices in what I thought was a very kind of compassionate and human-centered way. I worked with Steph at Doblin for a time. She was there for much longer than I was, but I was there long enough to get the gist of it and get some great training. And then Steph and I moved on to Design Concepts at that time, now Delve. And I think I was there for about 5 years. You guys, when you instituted the little award that you would get for 5 years, the big screw that you would get, and then you were going to get one every 5 years. Well, I got one of those and then was lucky enough to get a chance to go to Korea and work for a year. A group called HCI, Human-Centered Innovation, for a large telecom company in Seoul. So there's a lot of stories to talk about innovation there. It was fascinating. But then I moved to the Bay Area and I've been at LinkedIn now for about 8 years, just about 8 years, which is unbelievable. And when I started, so an interesting story, I don't know how much you want me to get into, but when I joined LinkedIn, I joined as an individual contributor researcher. And there were two researchers altogether at LinkedIn at that time. And I was given the opportunity to lead and grow the team, and the organization had a real appetite for the kind of work that we do across the product development lifecycle, really focused on design thinking and qualitative and very humanistic approaches to grow the team to about 45 people now. We're a global team. And that's, yeah, I have certainly a lot of stories to talk about there in terms of moving from a very small, scrappy team to still a scrappy team, but you know, much more embedded in the process of product development and design now. So that's a quick sketch.
So much to dive into. Let me start with a couple of questions sort of inspired by your background. You started LinkedIn when there were two researchers, and you mentioned you've now grown it to quite a global team. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you would tell our listeners who probably take more of an ad hoc approach to capturing the voice of their users. What have you learned, or what are the advantages of taking a professional approach to understanding insights and observations versus some of our listeners might think, hey, I know who my customers are. I know who my users are.
Something I didn't mention, that I'm also leading now the user experience writing team. And I mentioned that because it's a very, there's a lot of similarities there where people think, oh, I write words, so I know how to write. So let me just do this. And then you see somebody who, and I've had, you know, I've been lucky enough to have witnessed this a number of times now. You see somebody who is actually a writer and who thinks like a writer. You see them apply their skills to an interface or to design problem, and you go, oh, yeah, that's really, really different. I remember when I was first started at LinkedIn, my first project was on, as a researcher, was on email. And we were getting a lot of feedback that we send a lot of email. So what was that experience like? So I did kind of a step back and looked at people's inboxes and how LinkedIn email fit into the context of that. And I did a little like linguistic analysis of what I was seeing, and had really deep conversations with people about their inbox experience and communications with companies, whether it's marketing or more kind of actionable types of communications. And I remember after a few interviews, the product manager took me aside and he was like, I've never seen anything like that. The way that you were able to talk to people, get them to open up, and then the way that themes are coming out that are really, really meaningful and help shed light. He's like, I've just never seen anything like that. So I think that one of the things we've done and tried to do is establish rigor and credibility, and establish that in a very big data context, and in a context at LinkedIn where metrics are everything, that research, user experience research, design research, deep research is not, it's not anecdotal. It's a process. It's very systematic. It's rigorous, and it's different. So you have to, there's a little bit of theater that goes along with that. And then there's a lot of really hard work that researchers do every day to communicate that to our stakeholders. So, you know, but I also will say there's a lot of research that goes on at LinkedIn. So there's user experience research, which is our own kind of brand of insight. But we also, you know, there's a lot of customer feedback that comes in through our customer support and customer service channels. There's market research, who's doing a lot of things, really valuable work, like NPS and customer satisfaction, and running kind of large scale omnibus studies and things like that. So as the user experience research team has grown, research in general has matured and grown as an organization at LinkedIn, which is now multi-tiered, super collaborative, and highly credible. But we will also get scrappy too. So we have some methods that we use. We're not that precious. So we empower designers to do their own research. We do intercept interviews that are kind of more structured and guided. When I first started, people would be like, oh, we'll just go to a hotel lobby and we'll ask people about this hiring platform. And we were like head exploding, like, oh my gosh, you can't do that because the people who you are your target users for this, they are not walking through a hotel lobby unless there happens to be an HR conference in town or something like that. You know, you need to have a little bit of structure and a little bit of guidance and some guardrails. It's not just a free for all, and put that structure around analyzing the unstructured data that you get back and knowing what it is and knowing what it isn't and stuff like that. So we've created some, like I said, guardrails around more scrappy research that allows people to feed that. I mean, I think everybody should be able to talk to people about how they're using their products and bring that back. But just knowing what it is and what it isn't and how that fits into the broader conversation of decision making versus gaining empathy versus learning somebody else's perspective, all of which are valuable, is, you know, that's something that we're constantly training people and ourselves to do within the organization.
So many questions that are inspired by that. I think one thing you talked earlier in your discussion about choices, mm-hmm. and I think at one level, one choice every manager, perhaps every listener of this podcast makes is how much of our resources, time, and energy do we focus on innovation as opposed to focusing on operational excellence or service or our brand or reducing costs? And I know you've got a good perspective because your team's research supports a wide variety of initiatives, not just innovation, mm-hmm. but also areas to improve service or brand, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Do you have any guidance or any lessons that you've learned over the years on what part of the portfolio of resources you would dedicate towards innovation? And I realize that's a loaded word that at some point we should probably work to define, but for whatever definition we're willing to accept, how much focus do you put on innovation?
Yeah, I guess the way I'd frame that for our company is, we were chatting on email a little bit prior. We don't talk too much about that. We don't use that word innovation all that much, but what we do talk about a lot is like strategy versus roadmap. So we work on a quarterly roadmap and decide, you know, collectively what we're going to build quarter over quarter. And then at the same time, we're also thinking more longer term and more strategically. So my team, we sit in the broader design team, which is called UED, User Experience Design, and that comprises research, user experience writing, design program management, and of course, design. We sit within the larger R&D organization, which is product. So working together, we do exactly what you said. We try to balance the portfolio of what our team is working on across what we call foundational work, formative work, and evaluative work. Foundational being the more what's feeding our strategy. And there's a lot of appetite within our company at the executive level, which is wonderful, for more foundational insight that's even removed from LinkedIn altogether. Just like, what are people's needs, motivations in the professional context that we can learn from and leverage and maybe shift our perspectives a little bit? You know, our vision as a company is to create economic opportunity for every member of the global workforce. And in order to do that, we need to constantly be shifting our perspective, challenging our assumptions, understanding that we are not the people that we're designing for. In the very early days of the company, we were, but that is no longer the case. So we need to be investing in that really foundational work, but in a targeted way. And then the second type of work we do is kind of more formative, which is once you have decided what problem you're going to solve, what needs you're going to go after, there's obviously, as you know all too well, you know, thousands and thousands of decisions that need to be made from the early stages of like, how are we going to meet this need in broader sketches to like, okay, now we're to the specific interactions and the flows, and we need to make sure that those are understandable, discoverable, usable, all of those things. So we do a lot of work concept testing from the early stages to the latter stages in the formative phases of product development. I think foundational work has a very sexy reputation. Oh, everybody wants to be doing strategic foundational work, right? Personally, I think two things. I think the decisions that are made in the formative stages are where the rubber hits the road. That is critical, critical work that really shapes the experiences that we're forming. And then secondly, I say we do a lot of formative work. The real truth is we do a lot of foundational slash formative work. We're always learning about the context of the users as we're testing concepts. So this division between what's strategic and what's tactical as a researcher specifically, I think is a little bit of a false dichotomy. While we do a lot of lab work and a lot of concept testing, the tendrils of that work, I think, span from informing foundational decisions, strategic decisions, as well as evaluative, which is the third kind of work that we do, which is more like usability testing. Like, how do we remove friction from the experience? Where are people getting stuck? When we do usability testing, the outcomes of that are much less vague. We call them WTFs, what to fixes. Like, there's really not a lot of negotiation for usability problems. We just need to fix them. Whereas, you know, foundational or even formative, we're hoping to engender a conversation around those things that teams can have together to make great collective decisions and consider all the trade-offs between user needs, business needs, and what technology is.
Julie, I think that's fascinating. I know I'm going to give Steph a chance to ask a question sooner or later, but I'm really intrigued. I think a lot of our listeners might be looking at the foundational insight research and say, that's a luxury I can't afford. Oh. I know you can't share specific examples, but do you have any kind of generalized examples where you can demonstrate that that foundational research really does pay dividends for a firm?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm having a lot of conversations with people about this right now, and it's really, really interesting. I think that there is a direct and indirect impact from doing foundational work. When it's indirect, it can make people feel a little bit uneasy, like, oh, what did we get out of this study? But it's really interesting for me to see. So we've done, I can share with you a couple of, you know, the sketches of a couple of studies we've done that are more broad. One is about active communities. I don't think it's any secret that LinkedIn is really creating a lot of exciting products that help professionals form communities and converse with each other. And this is a very human thing. It's a very exciting thing. But we took a step back and looked at, like, what does it mean to have an active professional community? And did a really robust diary study and came up with a framework of how we would define a healthy, active community. And that framework, this work was done, I want to say, a couple of years ago. And at the time, I think people were like, this is incredible work. This is brilliant. People love the stories. They love to understand. And the framework really resonated with people. But at the same time, it was like, okay, well, that's nice to know. Individual teams took those frameworks and created roadmaps from them. Okay, well, we need to make sure that we're creating a community that has parameters. What does that mean? We need to create a community that has purpose. We need to make sure the right people are there. We need to make sure those people are participating. So it gave individual product teams like something to really, really anchor on. And then what you started to see over time was at the executive level, this framework and this way of thinking had an indirect effect of really altering the course of roadmap and strategy over time. It's just really been interesting for me to see that influence versus impact, or influence and impact, like a yin and a yang. I think for foundational work, the desire and the frustration can be like, we need to see immediate impact from this. And the truth is that that's not even necessarily what it's intended to do. Right? It's intended to change the culture, change the mindset, shift the perspective, get into people's minds, change the way that they're even approaching the problem in ways that are sometimes undetectable, which is a challenging position for research to be in. You know, another example is on the enterprise side, because more than half of my team works on enterprise products, not on the consumer products that LinkedIn is kind of known for by most people. And we did a very interesting marketplace study about the hiring marketplace and the dynamics between job seekers and recruiters and hiring managers internationally. It was a really interesting study. One of the things that was really highlighted, and I think about some projects I did actually when I was working with you guys all the time and stuff like this, was about the power dynamics between the user groups within the system and the disconnects between that causes. I'm not revealing any secrets, you know, by saying that, you know, there's a real power dynamic between job seekers and hiring managers and enterprises who are hiring that really favor a lot of the times the hirer, not the hiree. So a lot of interesting conversations, and you know, LinkedIn operates from a place of very, very strong integrity and compassion. So a lot of conversations about, what does that mean to us? How do we create products now that help to level that? We're never going to eliminate it. I don't think it's necessary or even desirable to do so, but how do we level that out? How do we make sure there's a fair exchange of information in the products that we're creating that doesn't make this worse? How do we reduce bias in the system that helps to level this playing field? How do we create more equitable conversations across this marketplace? So that's the kind of thing that certainly you can point to specific initiatives that came out of those studies and be very proud of the impact that they had. But what I'm even more proud of over time is how I've seen our product shift in response to these kind of deep insights. So, you know, to the point of like, can you afford it? You know, is it worth the time? Is it worth the investment? I guess it depends on your company's values in some ways.
Excellent. A lot of the things that you just were talking about alludes to a very strong culture. Mm-hmm. You mentioned values. I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about the culture at LinkedIn and how that supports creativity, invention, innovation. And then more specifically, I'm really curious about the culture you've created with your team, because you are walking that line between trying to get people information fast, the foundational, the formative, the evaluative. I'm sure that can create some tension at times. So I'd like you to address the topic of culture.
Culture. So LinkedIn, when I started, was about 2,500 people. And at that time, of course, I thought that was huge. Now we're, I want to say, about 16,000 employees and part of Microsoft, which is over 100,000 employees. So that's a lot of growth. My team, of course, grew from 2 to 45 people, and all the teams around me, you know, likewise growing at a similar rate. So I think one of the things that hasn't changed in all of that time and through all of that growth has been our culture and our values. Our mission statement and our vision statement have remained exactly the same. The values that guide us are constantly reiterated by our wonderful CEO, Jeff Weiner. He has every 2 weeks he hosts a meeting where he talks about our top priorities, the first one of which is talent, meaning us, the people, and then trust and member value and customer value. And we talk through these every 2 weeks. And he makes a point of emphasizing our values, right? Relationships matter, act like an owner, inspire excellence, relationships matter, all of those things. So those things are really our guiding force. And we also hold each other accountable to them. Be open, honest, and constructive is one of our core values. And that's not easy to do. But when we all hold each other to those standards, you know, that's just the consistency and solidity of those company values has been just incredible to behold. And a great lesson in leadership. You can't say them often enough, and you can't reinforce them often enough.
Do you think any of those values that you just identified, sorry for interrupting, have a direct correlation or any correlation to creativity?
I mean, I think...
Is that a value of your company?
Not explicitly, but we're very much a culture of experimentation and creation. We come from this very entrepreneurial, experimental startup culture, so... transformation is really what we talk about more than creativity. Okay. We are constantly trying to transform ourselves, our products, our company, the world. It's a very scalable notion, transformation. So I guess that's how we really frame creativity. For the design team, of course, creativity is super important. And we just had Creativity In Day, as a matter of fact. Every month we have one day that is dedicated to a theme, and our VP of design was the executive sponsor of Creativity In Day, and it was just a lot of fun. We have a very maker kind of culture on the design team. We have maker hours that kind of inspire that. Creativity and innovation, the relationship between those things, and play, I think are very, very important. But in innovation and creativity, I think are more kind of driven by constraints. whereas, you know, pure creativity and play are unrestrained. That's where I think that interplay is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. For my team, you know, we have values that define us. We, of course, you know, anchor on the company values, but our own two values that we talk about a lot are being rigorous and experimental.
Nice tension.
Yes, rigorous and experimental, as well as being curious, social. Those are all diplomatic. Like, those are all things that we talk about as researchers that are really, really important to us. And rigor kind of speaks directly to Dave's point about, Dave's question earlier about, like, how do you create credibility in the organization for this kind of work and not just think like literally once I had somebody at LinkedIn who was not on the research team say to me, well, we don't need to do usability testing because I talked to some people at a cocktail party about this feature and I understand what we need to do to fix it. And I was like, that's great that you did that, but that's not usability. Let me explain to you exactly what that method is and how that works. And so we really do lead with rigor when we talk about the work that we do. But we also don't want to be stagnant. You know, we want to constantly be transforming and contributing to the practice of research as a discipline. So it's easy to get into a routine, right? We're going to do a lab study and we're going to talk to 10 people and it's going to be, you know, da 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 da. But it's really important that within that rigorous construct, there's so many methods that we can use where we can still be very, very rigorous, but also be very experimental.
So Julie, relative to that, I think a common perception amongst our listeners is that software and maybe the social media platforms such as LinkedIn, Facebook, et cetera, that you kind of have a little bit of an unfair innovation advantage because of the speed with which you can experiment and prototype. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that? Does that represent something that you know your company can take on that other companies can't, or is that maybe naive?
I think there's some truth to that. I mean, the affordance of literally what we're designing and how we're designing it allows us to experiment thousands of times, you know, across the platform. So do we have an unfair advantage? You know, it's interesting. I think there's, talking about tension, there can sometimes be like a rush to experiment before really understanding what the problem is that we're solving, what those needs are, what people's context is, what their workflow is, how it might work in the world, the implications of a feature or a product. So I think that there's both an advantage and a disadvantage of working in this way. And my teams, both research and writing, kind of sit right at the intersection of that. We're really focused on giving people that deep information in order to feed experiments that are both fruitful and ethical within the system. And I mean ethical in many different respects. So in some ways I would say it's an advantage, and in some ways I would say it's a bit of a disadvantage, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for our non-software listeners on how you think the basic principles of innovation and discovery that you've implemented or learned could be perhaps applied to other industries?
There are so many ways to experiment, right? Like in the digital software, like social media realm, we can experiment in real time with real data. And I think that's great. And some of those are controlled experiments. And I think the earlier that we experiment not in the system, but with proxy methods, just reduces risk and is safer and better for everybody. And you don't need to be working in a software or a digital realm to do that. I think this concept of tiny experiments to kind of figure out the right way into a problem can be done by anybody. Can you do it, you know, at the scale that we can do it to kind of capture those metrics and understand kind of how different changes or different experiments will impact users, create value to users, to the business, all of that stuff. It's very complex, but maybe you can't do that as effectively or at that scale, but certainly the act of experimenting, you know, anybody can do it. And in fact, I think for products and types of products and services that require more upfront investment, whether it's tooling or whatever, you are doing that early experiment. You're even more compelled to do that because you can't take it back. If you make a certain decision and it's not the right decision and you didn't experiment and kind of figure out at a micro and at a macro level what you're doing is useful, usable, valuable, and is going to work right, you know, you just really created some problems for yourself.
So true. I wanted to circle back one more, take another crack at culture, if you will. I know, you know, we talked about having grown from 2 researchers to 45.
Uh-huh.
I know that you're not all co-located, not in the same building, not in the same campus, sometimes not, especially right now because of the current situation, you're all working from home.
We are.
But can you talk about or give some advice on what it takes to create a strong and vibrant culture in that environment?
Yeah, there's so many dimensions of that. The first one that comes to my mind is you need leaders who are willing to learn and grow and change and listen. My personal journey through growing a team, leading a team, has been one of extraordinary personal growth. And I think that to establish a strong culture where people are going to follow you, they're going to want to be with you on your team, that you're all working together, requires that kind of vulnerable and deep commitment to leadership. And I'm fortunate enough to have a team of leaders working for me that feel that same way. So that's really important. And then, you know, there's consistency. We have just tactical things that we do. We also have a meeting every 2 weeks, and I have it organized into, you know, we talked a lot over the years about what do we want this meeting to do? And at first it was like, oh, we'll do a round table and everybody's going to talk about what they're working on. And, you know, that was interesting when it was like 7 or 8 people. And then it was like totally redundant because we were always talking about the same things. And then as we grew, it's a constant reassessment of what the team needs, what they're thinking about, what's important to them. So now our team meeting is really fun. The first thing we do is called Me in a Minute. So any person on the team can sign up and just talk about themselves for like 5 minutes. It's not really a minute. It could be like a trip they took or something about their background and culture or something that they're really interested in. Like one person did one on pictures of himself wearing hats over the years. Another person recently did a really great like quiz on plant life because she's really into plants. So it's really just like personal, getting to know each other. And then we do a couple different segments. One is called Wheels on the Bus, which is like operational stuff. Like, what do we all need to do to make sure we're being operationally sound? We have a word segment, which is our UX writers, where they talk to us about the work that they're doing. And then we devote most of the time to what we call a nerd alert. So that could be somebody bringing something back from a conference that they went to and sharing something that they learned. We've had some great ones on like cognitive heuristics and behavioral science, really reading out like deep research reports, book reports, anything. Storytelling, like how do we think about storytelling as researchers? So anything anybody wants to like really nerd out on, we give ourselves time for that. So we've created that together time. That's, I know I value. One thing I forgot to mention that's super important in that meeting is gratitude. We probably spend 15 minutes every single meeting doing a gratitude roundabout. So we just like toss it to each other. Well, I'm grateful for this person helping me, give me feedback on my presentation. You know, I'm grateful for a new researcher running their first study and really nailing it, whatever it is. I was grateful once for somebody retrieving a lost jacket I left in the San Francisco building, which is impossible. I thought I'd never find it. So whatever it is, we just try to really express that natural gratitude we have for each other. So I think having those forums for authentic, and by the way, you know, recently you may have heard, our CEO is moving into an executive chairman role, and we had some really significant leadership changes. So because of the tone that we have at our team meetings, I was so proud that that forum was used for really honest discussion about how people were feeling, what they saw, what they felt, what they were worried about. We could share that with each other in a really open way. And as a leader, like I didn't always have all the answers, but I was so grateful for the questions and for the conversation and committed to bring that to my leadership and holding them accountable, being true to our values as well. So really, really proud of that. The other thing I do every year is I look at the organization because it changes so much. And I come up with like two or three words for the team to kind of anchor on every year. These are things that I think are going to help us be successful, things that I think we can work on together. And this year there were 3 words. One is consistency. So as we grow and scale as a team, we have a growing operations team, which is incredible. And we need to work together to make sure that our work is consistent and rigorous. And the second one was curiosity, which seems like a natural thing for a research and writing team, but really doubling down on, like, we need to work with other insights partners, data science, market research, do secondary research, like look out into the world, like really lead with curiosity and also be curious in the moments of tension on your projects, right? Lean into that. Lean into your daily life with curiosity. Don't make assumptions. And then the third one is courage. And I think we, in the tech world right now, as we face the issues that we do, and as a field, as a design field, I think courage is really, really important right now. It's very important for us to be able to listen with courage, listen with the desire to be heard, to be changed by what you're hearing from other people. Listening takes a lot of courage. Changing takes a lot of courage. And then speaking up, saying what's really on your mind. We talk a lot about diversity at LinkedIn, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, creating diverse teams, creating a diverse workplace and a diverse workforce. But in order to really realize the benefits of diversity, it requires every single person involved to be very, very courageous in the conversations that we're having with each other. So courage was a really important one for us. You know, I work with the team and I observe and I use my research kind of instincts to identify the needs for the team and then rally people around some concepts. And people really take to that. They like the words, they use the words. We have training, learning and development, that kind of circles around these different themes for the team. And we try to be real consistent about that. So yeah, culture is everything from like a real deep internal journey to like specific tactics and reinforcing the things that you talk about as leaders.
It's really clear from your conversation and from some of the opportunities I've had to observe LinkedIn at work by visiting you there, that it does have a very strong culture. It's visible on the walls of the building and the way that people interact with each other. And I really appreciate a lot of what you talked about had to do, or at least illuminated for me, these tensions, right? That it's not this simple, follow this formula and everything will be great. It's about understanding where these tension points are and in a way celebrating them.
Yeah.
So being rigorous, but also being experimental, being consistent, but also being curious. And there's a lot of these things that people might feel on the surface are opposites, but are in fact both critical for success. And it appears that that's embodied in the leadership at LinkedIn in general, but specifically and more pointedly to the leadership that you portray with your groups.
Well, thank you. I'm going to actually add one more tension to that about culture, which kind of ties to what I was saying about courage a little bit, but I'll be more pointed about it. You know, we talk about culture as being kind of this rock solid thing and this anchor that we really rely on. And that's really true. But it's also, as you invite new people onto the team, especially people from diverse backgrounds and diverse races and different parts of the world, different cultures, you have to be open to changing your culture. Your culture is changed by every single person who joins your team. And if you have a monoculture that isn't willing to change as you bring new people into that culture, and if leadership isn't willing to evolve, change, and shift and grow with that team, that is not a living culture. That is a stagnant culture that is going to cause people to feel repressed. Like, oh, you've invited me to be part of this team, but you actually don't really want to hear what I have to say. You don't want to be changed by my perspective. But really, we do. So the trick is finding that balance and that tension between, like, we know who we are, we know what we stand for, that is unwavering. You can actually help us live those things even better than we do today by what you're bringing to the table and by challenging the way that we do things. And we need you to do that. We want you to do that. It's the only way that we're going to actually achieve our objectives together. So I really enjoy the notion of culture as, again, you know, a collection of people making choices together and changing their environment and changing their community and changing, hopefully, the world through what we put out there.
Really well spoken, and way to tie it all back to the beginning about choices. One thing in particular you said that I'm going to walk away with and use going forward is this notion of listening with the desire to change. And that is just such a different way of listening to what people say, not listening to think about what your answer is or how it fits with your current construct, but really listening with a desire to change.
Yeah.
So thank you. This was really great.
Of course. I can't remember exactly where I heard that, but I actually heard that recently and it made a light bulb go off for me too. I'm trying to practice that. Yeah, and share that. I love it too.
Yeah.
Julia, this has been fantastic. I want to be respectful of your time, maybe time for a couple more questions. You talked a little bit about the challenges the tech industry is facing, really all firms are facing as we grapple with issues of diversity, inclusion, fairness. Mm-hmm. And one thing we passionately believe here, can you help me for our listeners build evidence that a focus on diversity, inclusion, trust actually has an impact on an organization's impact to innovate?
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many examples of how not having diverse teams creates problems for people out in the world. You know, I think an example that we talk about a lot is when hand dryers were designed, they were designed exclusively by white people. So they don't recognize darker skin and then they don't function for people of color. If you had had a diverse team building that product, that would not have happened. If you had brought diversity even into the testing process, if you had taken a diverse and inclusive approach to the research, even in the absence of having a diverse team of engineers and designers building it, that would never have happened. So I think there are the downstream effects of not having diversity in the business case for that are both, I think, moral, of course, but if you're eliminating usage of products by vast swaths of the population because you haven't considered them, either excluding them from the ability to use your product altogether or creating products that are offensive to them to the degree that they won't participate in them, that's just not good business. I think it's pretty clear. And at least, you know, in the tech industry, we, especially I can only really speak for LinkedIn, but we find that to be very, very clear. But then how you do that, you know, one of the things that the research team is doing, I just kind of alluded to it, but every company in tech has a quote unquote diversity problem, which really simply means that we haven't hired enough women, people of color, people from underrepresented minorities. Our workforces do not reflect the population of the people that we're building for, and that's a problem. And that's something to be worked on, and we really, really are. But as we work on that, it is incumbent on researchers to create inclusive practices so that when we are testing our products and building for a very diverse population of users, we are including those people in the process. It's kind of a shift of designing for versus designing with, which is what we want to be doing a lot more of. It helps certainly reduce risk, expand your user base, avoid PR issues. You know, the laundry list goes on and on of the benefits of diversity. And plus, if I can just say, it's more fun. It's way, way, way more fun, rewarding, enjoyable, exciting to work with people who are from different backgrounds, whether that's gender, age, race, culture, whatever, you name it. It's just a lot more interesting and a lot more fun. And I think that the products that we put out into the world reflect the experiences that the people who are building them are having with each other. That's a direct correlation in my mind. If a product is made by a dysfunctional team who's not working together, who's not diverse, it's very easy to see that.
Very, very well stated and an inspiring point. Well, I think in the interest of time, we probably ought to wrap this up, but Julie, I've really enjoyed and appreciated. This has been a tremendous conversation, some excellent insights. For myself, I know that we are going to be having a gratitude component to our upcoming staff meeting as a result of this. So that was lots of great strategy as well in terms of really focusing on culture and innovation. Once again, Dave Franchino here, and I've really enjoyed this conversation, joined by our Vice President of Strategy, Steph Nervices, and delighted with our conversation with today's guest, Julia Nervices, Senior Director of User Experience and Research at LinkedIn. Julie, so thank you so very much for your time. We've really appreciated it.
Thank you, Dave and Steph. I really enjoyed the conversation today as
Thanks
well.
Thanks for listening.
Yes.
You can find more podcast episodes, articles, and other resources on design and innovation at delve.com.